Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome back to Inside the Hive. I'm Emily Jane Fox. I'm here, and I'm here with my buddy, Joe Hagan. Hey.
Hey, hey, hey.
I'm so happy to be here.
Back in the saddle.
Yeah,
me too. I'm glad you're here.
This is going to be our new normal. We're really getting back to, well, our new old normal. But we're getting back to it. Mm-hmm. Life is sort of getting back to normal around here.
And we're hoping that, you know, we're setting a trend for the rest of society to get back to its new normal. And we want to. I was just thinking the other day, we were worried about the Omicron. And we may have less to worry about than we thought. It seems like it's good that we were cautious, but maybe it'll be okay. I was reading a few days ago that said, you know, in 3 months' time, they'll have a new booster shot for the Omicron. And I was like, wow. And I had just gotten a booster this week. So I was just thinking about how many shots am I going to end up getting in my lifetime for this virus? And then I was thinking, the new kind of like pickup line is going to be that I've been vaxxed, boosted, and Omicroned.
And then whatever comes after Omicron, right? I think that this is just going to be a reality where we are constantly, I mean, maybe, I don't know, what do I know? But maybe we're getting boosted all the time and there's new variants and some of them are going to be as severe as Delta and communicable as Delta, and some of them are going to be as communicable but maybe less severe like Omicron. And we're just going to live in this cycle for a long time, I think, and we will learn to take calculated risks as we have. It's funny, I feel like I am now really starting to know so many more people who are getting sick or getting infected, even post-booster. And that doesn't mean that the boosters don't work. I think what we're seeing is, okay, if you're going to live back like a normal existence, you're going to go to events and conferences and you're going to travel and you're going to have kids in school, you are taking calculated risks. And I don't think anyone wants to live in a world where you don't take those calculated risks. And not good. Everyone I know who has gotten sick has been okay. They haven't been, it hasn't been smooth sailing and it hasn't been easy. And I think people felt not well, but the vaccine does work at keeping this at a general illness and not something that's catastrophic or life-threatening. So this is where we are.
That's right. And the difference between getting sick and not dying and getting it and dying is a giant difference.
It's meaningful.
So it's a meaningful. And so, you know, every report you see, the doctors are saying the hospitals are filling up with people who have refused to get vaccinated. And of course, they're displacing all the resources for people that have other kinds of illnesses. Mm. Right. And this has just obviously been a theme for weeks and months on end, this idea of the anti-vaxxed getting the illness after being morons for as long as they have been. You know, I just, right here in my town, a prominent local figure who owned and ran a restaurant, didn't get vaxxed, got it, and within 2 days was dead.
Oh, God.
And it's real. I mean, we read about it in the paper, and if you haven't been touched with it in an immediate way, you must know by now that this is a thing that can touch you out of the blue. And so get vaxxed. Of course, you don't need to be told that if you're listening to this podcast. You likely have done it, but trying to encourage everybody else to do it.
How do you feel post-booster?
Anyway, you know, I felt terrible yesterday, and it wiped me out pretty hard. I've had little waves of it today, but I'm mainly fine. I'm just glad to have gotten it. And, you know, I just went to a pharmacy. It's so weird that pharmacists are now coming out from behind there and giving you a shot.
It's crazy.
Just a bizarre thing. But and the woman who gave me the, and I also got a flu shot, so I had one in each arm. Mm-hmm. And it was just like next day I was like neither arm was really doing great.
Yeah.
But the woman who worked there says, you know, she said, I just wish that everybody would get vaccinated, but there's still all these people that won't do it. And so, you know, it's frustrating for the people that are trying to get everybody vaxxed to see all this, you know, resistance to it. Any case, that is, but mainly I feel like we're moving in the right direction. I think I saw a number yesterday that like 60% of the country is vaxxed. That's the majority of people, and we're heading in the right direction.
Great. I mean, and you keep seeing things about mandates and companies taking lines. I know at our company, I showed proof of vaccination, and basically everywhere I go into, my in-laws were here this week, which is lovely, and we were going out to dinners outside still, and even sitting outside, I had to show proof of vaccination at our local neighborhood restaurant, and great. I will pull this card up as often as I possibly can, and I was invited to a conference next week that I may or may not be able to go to, and it's required to be vaccinated and proof of a test 72 hours before the event. So this is just sort of the thing that we're going to have to do, and I'm game for all of it. I think we should all do all the things. Can I just say something really quickly? And then we have a lot of more uplifting things to talk about, but I wasn't on the podcast last week, and I talked about this with some friends of mine who, when we were talking about all of the choice stuff that's happening on the Supreme Court. And I know this is the most obvious point for anyone who's a thoughtful person, but I literally think about it every day. The fact that people are anti-vaccine mandate and also don't want women to be able to choose what is done to their bodies and also oppose gun legislation is the most intellectually hypocritical thing in the entire world. And I know it's obvious. I know it's been said a million times, but I just think we need to keep saying it over and over and over again, because it's the most ludicrous thing in the entire world. And all it is extreme sexism and backwards thinking. And if we continue to just roll our eyes at it rather than name what it is, it'll just keep going on. So hopefully we can just continue to name it out loud and point out the fact that it is wildly hypocritical, illogical, and deeply sexist.
And can I just add dumb?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to say it's really dumb.
That's the word that I meant to say.
It makes smoke come out of my ears when I think about how hypocritical it is. And when I think about these school shootings, when I think about these Republican politicians who think it's funny to have like a Christmas card picture with their kids with assault rifles in their hands, it makes me want to throw up, and it just makes me depressed and sad. Now, we're all experiencing that, you know, on a daily basis as to the degree we come in contact with these, you know, pictures and kind of negative campaigning these people are doing for their own political lives. But I do think and this is just a gut feeling, and occasionally I'll come out here and say something that is optimistic just based on a gut feeling, but I do feel like we're kind of heading in the right direction right now. There's been a lot of articles in The Atlantic, you know, in The Washington Post and elsewhere, where you have people writing op-eds saying, we have to be terrified that the Trump right is slowly altering and gerrymandering and altering the voting rights around the country, and they are going to destroy democracy and you know, install a fascist government, you know, in which all Christmas cards will have assault rifles in them, right? But I'm not saying that can't happen, and I think it's great to be vigilant, and I hope they'll keep writing those op-eds and writing those articles in Atlantic about what's going on and keep the bright shining light on these things. But I just feel like the energy of that stuff is becoming more and more on the margins. If 60% of the country is vaccinated, that means 60% of the country has some grip on reality.
Or
right?
They have some grip on reality, or they're required to by their employers, or they're bummed about not being able to eat inside of a restaurant or go to a gym.
And that may be true, but I also think that some of the requirements are certainly there, but they also saw a huge spike of people getting vaccinated when the reports of this Omicron thing came around.
That's true. Very true.
And I'm just, you know, so some of it's just sheer, you know, laziness, or they just don't want to be involved, or they just don't can't be bothered. Maybe they're not in a job or a circumstance in which they feel like they have to care, right? They're not getting out and around people or whatever the case may be. But I've been reading in the today, the Biden administration is sort of trying to point out, and some columnists have written about this, that the economy is much better than people even understand, that Biden has done almost like a historic level of turnaround on the economy. The unemployment numbers are down. There's a record number of the number of people out looking for work is very low. You know, the main kind of impediment to people feeling like the economy is doing well has a lot to do with messaging, and, you know, a lack of messaging, I would say. As I've spoken on this podcast in the past, I think the Biden administration has been poor on getting out there and presenting. I mean, I think I don't know why that is. You know, I don't know why Biden's not more frontal about what the victories are. And maybe he doesn't feel like he's a good messenger of his own success. I don't know what it is. But and on the other hand, we're so distracted by the virus. We're so distracted by right-wing messaging. Did you see this Tucker Carlson thing, of the latest outrage? I shouldn't even bring it up because I hate that guy.
I haven't seen it. I want to know, and I don't want to know.
I'm not going to mention it. You know, I just decided if you want to know what idiotic thing he said, but the point is,
don't want to know that. Free yourself.
It's
from
a distraction. Yeah, there's. I just forgot it actually.
Good.
So there's this there's this distraction cloud that the right has created to constantly distract you from, you know, normalcy. And I think mostly it's not working. I mean, if it's you or me, people in the media, we're paying attention, and to some degree we're victims of it because we feel like we have to cover it or say something about it. But,
you know, Joe, as you bring up this Tucker Carlson thing, I have realized, and I talked about this a little bit with Jon Favreau when we had him on the podcast, I've become less curious. I think that I used to be like, I had to know everything that was going on, and I was like intensely, I prided myself on that, and I was very curious about knowing everything in the news. And I don't think I'm an incurious person now, but I have put up intellectual boundaries on my life, and I don't want to know the things that don't feel completely essential and upsetting. So if there are things that are upsetting but are essential, I will take the time to learn about them. But I now have put up a news boundary. And my news boundary is not letting anything into my brain that is upsetting and needlessly so. Maybe that makes me a bad news person, but I don't care.
You know what that makes you? It makes you a sane person.
I'm trying, because we were all so absolutely insane for 5-6 years, and I can't do it anymore. I'm right. Preserving my sanity for when it really matters.
Well, we're rebuilding sanity.
Yes,
you know,
that's
it's a brick by brick. That's build back better. Build sanity back better. That's really nice. I like that. That's new inside the hive.
That's our position for Inside the Hive. I'm running on that platform for our platform.
Yeah, I like that.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
About building back better in our professional lives here. You and I both have some stories to talk about.
Well, it's funny. It's exactly thematically perfect because it's about people trying to regain sanity. Mm. And just to put another sort of thematic layer on it, it's interesting because you wrote a profile of somebody from the political world who is finding sanity through art. And on the other side, I wrote about somebody who is really an artist, but who is trying to make sanity out of politics.
What an astute right? point that is. And both in Los Angeles.
That's right.
And this is what an astute point that is. You wrote a fantastic fantastic profile of Adam McKay. And I'm sure that people listening to this have all read your writing, because how could you not? They listen to you, and also you've written about everybody for major publications for many years in your young life. But Joe is a master at this class. I don't think that there's anyone better at working as a professional journalist than Joe Hagan at profile writing. He is truly the gold standard. Every journalist wants to be him. They want to write like him. They want to report like him. And it is such an art, Joe. You are an artist in this. But this profile of Adam McKay at this moment in time, when he has a big movie coming out, it's so funny because the profile starts with him basically trying to write the beginning of the profile for you and saying that the art of this kind of personal profile is dead, and it's from the past. And I think you go on to disprove his theory. This is very much something that's happening in the present because of you and because of how well you did this. But I also just think, and other reporters will know this, and people who are very keen on magazine profile writing and reading, you did something that was masterful. You had someone who was clearly very self-conscious about participating in this completely open up. You go from someone who is very obviously hesitant to sit down and talk to you and do this to immediately him talking about his therapist and probably the most personal career breakup of his life and why he's doing the art he's doing and his politics and his mood and his state of mind. It's a real masterclass to get someone to be that comfortable, particularly when they're starting from a place where they're uncomfortable with the whole idea. So I'm curious how you got Adam McKay to share his soft spots with you.
Well, first of all, I'm blushing and flattered by all those things you're saying. Yeah, we'll move on. But, you know, I'm sitting here a little verklempt, so you have to give me that. That's very kind of you to say. But
it's truth.
It's really a little bit about just, in this particular case especially, understanding who he is and what he is. I was a fan. Mm. So, you know, I'm a fan of some of his movies. But I also understood right away when I began talking with him, I usually have a little pre-conversation with somebody about what should we do and how might this go down and let's make it different. Let's make it better. And he's a born collaborator, right? He wants to collaborate. And he's also somebody who likes control. You know, you can tell that he would like to help you and then have some hand in sort of shaping what happens. And so I was just sort of surfing with it for a while, not knowing where all this is going. But I could tell that he was game and that he wanted to have fun. And he's a funny guy. Right. You could just tell right off the top, Adam McKay, funny guy. As I mentioned in the piece, he sort of made this joke about that we would play a one-on-one basketball game and that whoever won would get to write the lead of my piece. Right. And at first I thought, oh, that'd be funny. Right. We could try that. But then I realized that he's a basketball fan and he's 6'5", and there was no way I was going to win that game. But he said, I'm going to write you these leads anyway. He kind of liked the idea of doing it. And I didn't know whether I was going to use them or what purpose they would serve. And he didn't send them to me until after I interviewed him. But just, you know, but just saying, yeah, let's do it. Just being game sort of opened him up. It made him feel like we were going to have fun. And I think that, you know, you just kind of roll with that. And let's be honest, too, just to be square here. We're roughly the same age and it was easy to relate to him. Right. He's from a similar cultural background and had the same touchstones, let's say, generationally. He's a Gen X guy. Right. But one of the fascinating things that I think people will find in this article that I was fascinated with is I decided to put in his fictional leads that he wrote into the piece. And it was not until I started to feather them into the piece and kind of think about the theme of the piece and also think about what his therapist had been telling him about his creative life that I began to realize how these were such self-revealing things that he had written, that they were all like parodies of himself as a jerk or some kind of like hypocrite or somebody who was like a rich Hollywood guy who had left-wing politics, right? Which he roughly, you know, is in composite, right? But he was mocking himself. And there's this, you know, humor, as we know, there's a kernel of truth to it. There's something there that he's mocking, and he's mocking himself. And I realized that I needed to dive into those insights that he's giving me. He may not be aware he's giving them to me. He thinks he's being funny. He's just being a comedian. Or maybe he is aware. But in any event, it was a great opportunity to have fun with the piece. And as you said, and this was the thing that made me pull my hair out and sweat and gnash my teeth in the writing process, is like, okay, if you're going to set up the piece at the beginning, and this is real workshop kind of writing talk here, but if you're going to set up the piece as like celebrity profiles are stupid and not worthwhile, you better prove him wrong by the end, you know? So it set up, it was a little bit of like, he was Babe Ruth aiming for the outfield and I had to hit the ball, right?
Yeah. So that's, it's entirely anyway, right. And I think what you're saying about, you know, the expression in wine, there's truth, that yes, oftentimes when people will drink, you will find out what they really think. I think that in what he gave you as these sort of jokey things that you should include in the story was the truth about how probably the things that he's most insecure about are the things he's either wanting to portray or scared you will portray. And I think that that is incredibly revealing about the things that he either wanted you to hit or the way he wanted you to hit them. And I think that you obviously teased out a great amount of meaning in that. And I also think that I hear you on you guys being of a piece, right? And then that made it easy for him to open up to you. But I think a great part of our jobs is, even when you can't relate to someone, is making them feel like they can relate to you, right? I think that when I describe my job or why I think I'm good at my job on the days where I do feel like I'm good at my job, and that's not all the time, it's a lot of forced intimacy, and yeah, you have to be really good at making people really comfortable quick in an incredibly uncomfortable situation, right? Like, that is a yes, huge part of our job. And whether or not you realize it or you stop and take the thing, it's like you're kind of a spy. You kind of have to disappear into the surrounding and make someone feel like you've been there for a really long time or that you're not there at all. Otherwise, you're not able to get the real of it, right? You just get someone who's pretty good at talking to reporters, telling you exactly what they want you to see. You have to disappear into it or make someone feel like you've been there forever.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you and I both know in this business, especially when you're writing about Hollywood or people in power, and which we do quite often, is that obviously everybody has something to sell, right? And so you're coming to them at a time when they do want something, right? But one thing I've come to understand is people want to be understood, right? And if you are there to say, I'm here to understand you, and I want to understand you, and you ask probing, interesting questions, it just, there's a sort of natural flow that can occur if you let yourself be relaxed and try to genuinely get to understand what's going on in their head and ask what might be otherwise tough questions in the context of trying to understand, which doesn't have to come off as confrontational or belligerent.
You can ask the tough questions if you are asking them in a way that feels like you're not asking them to ask because you have to ask the tough questions, right? They have to be part of a larger thing. And by the time you get to the tough question that they knew you were going to ask and that they feared you were going to ask, that you've built enough trust with that person that you are actually listening to what they're saying in order to give you the right answer or the thoughtful answer to that tough question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a character in my story, and I think that it's worth just noting that he had a therapist, this guy Barry Michaels, right? And Barry Michaels, there's a New Yorker profile of him, kind of famous one of him, that's really great because he's like a well-known Hollywood super therapist, right? He has all these unconventional ways of getting people in touch with their shadow self, right? And it's like, you know, kind of like fancy talk for just your unconscious, you know, creative flow. And you just want to get out of the way of your own mind and become more creative. And he has all these ways of doing it. And it can sound kind of ridiculous when you're talking about Hollywood people going and trying to undo their writer's block with a super therapist. But in many ways, as you know, Emily, we are often put in the position of being a kind of therapist. You know, you're sitting there kind of asking very similar questions that a therapist would ask. Tell me about your mother, right? And in the case, for instance, of Adam McKay, his mother is a right-wing Trumper and religious and stuff. So immediately you've unpacked something. And I have a friend, a very good, dear friend named John, who's a therapist in the West Village in New York and has a lot of, like, you know, high-powered clients and stuff. And, you know, we talk about this all the time, how we're basically in the same business. And, you know, we're unpacking people's motivations and trying to find out, like, what's driving them, right? So, and this is about as good a segue as possible to your story, which, if you are listening to this podcast right now, you should open up vanityfair.com. It's very likely it's going to be there. If not today, then tomorrow. A profile that Emily has written, and I know she's been spending weeks on this because I've known about this in the background for some time. A very fascinating profile, which I finished like an hour ago. She gave me a preview. Such are the you know, benefits of being co-host of Inside the Hive. Mm-hmm. And it is such a fabulous piece. I think the first thing I told you is, like, this reminds me of like a classic profile from like New York Magazine in the 1970s. Ugh. It just has this great, you know, it's an encounter, right? I love encounter pieces, right? Where you're just, it's a little bit more than a talk of the town piece. It has a richer feel to it. And of course, we are talking about another person trying to build back better. It's Build Back Better Jr.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
And that would be Hunter Biden. And what you've written about here is his new gig as an abstract painter.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS, just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, it's, well, I will say the first time I spoke to him was here on this podcast when he had his book come out.
I was about to say that, yeah.
In the spring, and it feels like a natural extension of things for me to write about. I spent so much time writing about the last first family. It's a very different family and a very different feel.
Yes.
But this was, it was fascinating. I think we've all known Hunter Biden, whether he likes it or not. Very intimately over the last few years, he has become the pawn in the right wing's game against Joe Biden. He was essentially the reason why the president, the former president Trump, got impeached over asking the Ukrainian government to dig up dirt on him in order to spook then candidate Joe Biden. And for someone who is so ostensibly known, I didn't really know him. And there has been such a narrative written about him. And I think he is now at a place where he's trying to write his own narrative. And he is painting every day. He lives up a hill, a very steep hill outside of Los Angeles, sort of tucked away with his wife and his 19-month-old son. And he is in his studio for 10 hours a day painting hundreds and hundreds of paintings. And I spent some time with him there and saw his process and saw what he does and saw the paint stained fingernails. And I went to his gallery opening here in Los Angeles, and he also had one in New York. And it's a really interesting thing. This is someone who is very committed to his art as part of his life post recovery and sort of post being in the public eye every day, but it presents some challenges. He is selling his artwork at a time where his dad is in office, and it poses some real ethical questions about who could possibly use a sale of artwork to gain access to his father. And the White House and the gallerist have put in some meaningful safeguards, but of course critics won't be quelled by any kind of ethical concern. Look, I spent so much time writing the last 5 years about the Trumps and the children and all the family members using their positions of power for personal gain. And so it is completely fair game to ask these questions. But the story obviously hits on that, but it's mostly about where our first son is in his artistic journey in his first chapter of this new life in Los Angeles.
Well, his paintings are, this is the real kind of like tension point in the piece is it's that the paintings are selling for extraordinary sums to buyers who we don't know, whose identities we don't know. I think one of them sold for like $300,000 or something, right? Which is, I happen to be friends with some extremely talented painters mm-hmm. who were at Art Basel just this last week.
Oh, wow.
Right? And, it would be like the sale of a lifetime for them to sell a painting for $300,000, right? And I'm not going to try to compare and contrast and say they're better than Hunter Biden as a painter's, but it is pretty extraordinary. Now, but you have seen these paintings, and one of the critics you cite in the piece compares them a little bit to Kandinsky, an abstract painter. I'm not like a aficionado of painting. I'm average art intelligence, but give us a little taste of what you saw.
Well, I would say I'm of average art intelligence also. That feels like a good way to paint me. But they're good. The artwork is good. I think that it is really impressive. And I think the artist Shepard Fairey, who is known for his Hope Obama posters, you guys have all seen them a million times. He was at the opening in LA and I spoke to him afterward and I was like, well, what do you think of all this? What do you make of the pricing and what do you make of the art? And he was like, for a guy who's just starting out, the style, like he has a lot of different styles and you can sort of see who he was influenced by, but there's some real good work here and you can tell he's giving it a lot of thought and attention. And the art world pricing is always nonsensical, right? I think that the reality is it's a very opaque process. And he was like, if people will pay that for him, good for him. His gallerist basically told me Hunter Biden is a figure in history. And so not only are you paying for art that is good, but you're paying for who he is. I understand that that gets factored into pricing. I can also understand how the fact that you're paying for who he is could be ethically challenging for someone whose father is still in office. One thing that I thought was really interesting, and I pressed him on this, why sell it now, right? Like mm-hmm. his explanation for why he is doing the art, and I will not do him justice. You should go read the story to hear his quotes about why he's doing the art. It's really beautiful. And I 1,000% understand, and it's emotional. He's coming from a place where he didn't think he was necessarily going to be here. He definitely didn't think he was going to be in such a good place, and he is, and I think that the art has a lot to do with that. So I understand why he's doing the art. I couldn't, going into interviewing him, understand why he was choosing to sell the art. And he told me that he recently had a friend say to him, why not just be an EMT or something like that? Like, do your art and don't sell it.
Would you mind if I read this?
Please.
Because this is, to me, this was the real amazing quote in the piece. And you can set, I don't know tonally if this quote, it feels like he got like a little emphatic here passionate, let's put it that mm-hmm. way. And so the setup here is his dad, you write, had waited so long for this moment. Hunter had for years just made it painting a soft hobby, right? Wouldn't it just be easier to take a lower profile job? Maybe he could be an EMT and paint on the side for fun. And here's his quote. Well, for starters, I don't want to be a fucking EMT, Hunter tells me. If you're going to make a painting that's 5 feet high and 22 feet long, you're going to want to show it to somebody. And if you're going to want to show it to somebody, you're going to want to show it to them in a place and in a way that brings to life what you are attempting to express. And if you do that, then you have to find a gallery in order to be able to do that. And if you find a gallery, the reason that galleries stay in business is because they sell the fucking art. I don't know of anybody else that has figured out a way to be able to share their art at that scale without having to be in the business of it somehow. And I respect that incredibly. So, and he goes on, there's some other quotes about this, but that was a pretty hot little moment because, you know, he's basically saying, I've decided to be a painter. Painters decide to show the paintings, and this is what you got to do if you want to do it. So he's basically saying my interest in painting, I guess, trumps these ethical questions.
The other thing is, he once said this to me, and I don't know that it's in the, I don't think it made it in the story, but he said to me basically, like, I chose something that I thought was going to be the least problematic. Like, painting is the farthest from politics that I could possibly do.
True.
It's not like he didn't go into law and then every case he would choose would be scrutinized. He didn't go into even medicine where you're then working with drug companies or he's not lobbying anymore. Like, painting is the furthest away from Washington that you could do. And so I understand this guy is, you know, he's in his early 50s. He's allowed to make money, right? It just, it's incredibly complicated. And I write in the piece that there's no such thing as a private Biden. And I don't know that there's a way for anyone adjacent to politician to live a private life anymore. And so I don't know what the solution is if you are going to have your life have to be public and you are going to want to have an income while you are in a famous political family. It's very tricky. I mean, Chelsea Clinton deals with this all the time too, right? It's a very tricky spot. And I don't think
that's right.
I don't think that you're going to have a situation where this is going to be black and white, cut and dry anymore.
Right. Well, I read his memoir, and he's a pretty candid guy. He's fairly introspective, and I guess he's thought it through enough that he's decided given the sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of scenario he's in, he's just going to paint, right? And if somebody wants to buy the painting for $300,000, what can he do about it, right? How old is he?
I think he's 52.
Because that's interesting, because Adam McKay is 53. So we're dealing with a similar demographic here and a similar interesting moment in their lives. And by the way, I know that just some of the fallout from my story, you know, Adam McKay, I think he appreciated the profile I wrote artistically,
how
but the Will Ferrell fallout, was very
upsetting
for him.
Let's talk about this. So you actually made serious news, and I saw, you know, oftentimes the best case scenario is someone is something that you write in a profile like this will catch attention of other writers, right? Like that's a great thing. It means you have made some news in a beautiful portrait that you have painted. And it's hard to do both of those things. Usually you have news or you have a beautiful portrait, but you have struck gold. You made some news within a beautiful portrait. And the news that you made surrounded his relationship and breakup with his former partner, Will Ferrell. Talk to us about the news, and then I want to hear your reaction. Sometimes, like, I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes when I make news about something in a profile, I feel a little thing about it. It feels like, I don't know if this is what I intended. I don't know if this is what I want to be pulled out of it. And then you just feel, I feel anxiety about it when it happens.
Well, I agree. Precisely. And so the news is that he and Will Ferrell, Adam McKay and Will Ferrell, were creative and comedic partners since their days at Saturday Night Live, right, in the 90s. They both came to Saturday Night Live, you know, really the same season. They were recruited the same week, and they began working together, and we know the story. It's Anchorman, Talladega Nights, all these famous comedies they did together. But there came a time when Adam McKay started to go in a different direction. Even though they had a production company together, people remember Funny or Die, the online comedy outlet. They started that together. They had this production company called Gary Sanchez Productions. So they were very bound together in their careers for a long while. And then Adam McKay began to want to make things like The Big Short and Vice. And there began to be a creative split. Eventually, the split becomes a tear. And they're sort of there were more than one inflection point in their kind of breakdown, but there was one in particular, and it had to do with, this really went to their personal, you know, friendship, even just beyond their business breakup, in which Will Ferrell expected to be cast in a new limited TV series that Adam McKay was making about the NBA Lakers in the 80s. And out of the blue, or behind the scenes, Adam McKay recasts the part that Will Ferrell was intending to have and made John C. Reilly, who happens to be Will Ferrell's best friend, gave him the part. And he did not tell Will Ferrell in advance this was happening, and Will Ferrell learned it from John C. Reilly. It's also ridiculous, but one thing leads to another, and they are no longer speaking. And Will Ferrell's infuriated, and Adam McKay confesses, I kind of blew it. I didn't exactly do that right, but I wish that it wouldn't end this way. But who knows? I mean, there's a lot of other things under the surface that will probably come out over time, but that was the inflection point, you know, or the straw that broke the camel's back. So this blows up. This is like this is three quarters into my piece, right?
It's thousands of words later.
Yeah, this is like in a 6,000 word piece, you know, it's at 4,000 or whatever. So, and it blew up. It went like global, you know, international news. It was everywhere. And I have to say, and I don't want to like let too much out of the bag here, but like Adam McKay, none too pleased, because he has this movie coming out. And he wanted his movies about climate change, and he has good intentions to tell a parable about our problematic society and its inability to cope with climate change. And he's personally very concerned with climate change. There's a line in the story that he says he says, you know, climate change is the biggest story in the history of upright apes, is one of the quotes, right? And he was complaining about, I can't believe this Will Ferrell story is now like everything I have to talk about in every interview after this story came out. And I said, well, you know, it turns out upright apes like gossip. And, you know, it's and in a sense, the next thing I told him was that's what your movie's basically about, right? The movie is about our inability to focus on important things because we're just so distracted by bullshit, right? Like the certain Fox News host who I mentioned in passing, and I almost became a victim of that, right? So, I mean, to get to my feelings about it, I don't like it I'm glad for the magazine because they like to have the traffic, right? Vanity Fair and The Hive, they can get traffic from big news stories and everybody loves news. But this is the conundrum of modern journalism.
It's not only that. I actually don't think it's a conundrum. You didn't publish the story with the intention of having clickbait. It wasn't the headline of the story. It wasn't that. You genuinely, within a 6,000 word story, made something that was so newsworthy that people picked up on it. You are just an empath, right? And you know that this was one piece of a much longer thing, and it wasn't the main thrust of the story, and it just happened to be so juicy that it caught attention and people lost sight of the main thrust of the story. And sometimes people's minds are so conditioned to the clickbait of it, right? And people made clickbait out of your much bigger story, and so you sort of feel possessive over like the overarching thesis rather than the bit of news, and that feels strange sometimes.
Very much, yeah. And you want people to like find out that this story, which they only got this little tiny slice of, is this thing that you labored over. You know, we're in a sense, you and I are portraitists, like, you know, from like the 17th century or whatever, and you're going to do like a giant painting with like, you know, a big gold frame around it, and it shows a dog and the wife and child and the, you know, lord of the manor, and they all have expressions on their face that tell you something about their inner lives. You know, we're doing these, and so you do it, and then the entire world just focuses on like a little, you know, grasshopper in the corner or whatever, and you're sort of like, hey, but I made this painting. So I'm not saying we're artists of that level or actual masters, but I'm just saying, you know, there's an analogy of like, if in our version of it, in our little world, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to create these things. But in any event, I'm happy that people read it and looked at it, and I have no complaints.
You know, it's funny because as your friend and colleague, I was so excited that it was getting so much attention. But as someone who could very easily put myself in your shoes, I knew that feeling that you were probably like, well, this is great that there are eyeballs on this, but is this what I want the eyeballs for? And this is one piece of it. I know that spiral that you can internally have. And I felt all of those feelings at once for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, thus is modern journalism. This is the world in which we live.
It is.
Or as John Homans would have said, this is the life we have chosen, right? He's quoting The Godfather 2 or whatever.
Exactly. As I sit here, like, my story is about to come out in any second, and I'm, like, terrified of 17 million things that could possibly happen. And all of them are opposing. So I don't know which thing is going to actually be the terrifying thing that will happen, but so many of them. Right now, the possibilities are endless, so...
Well, you're right at the precipice right now, because as we sit here and speak, the Hunter Biden piece has not come out yet. But I'm sure we will be talking about it. And it's very likely that the quote I read, for instance,
it's always what you don't expect. That's the reality. Yeah. Sometimes, you're like, oh, this is news and it's going to get pulled out. And other times it's not the news that you expect. And it's this one other thing that you're like, oh, that's totally innocuous. I wasn't even going to put that in there. And that's the thing. And sometimes it's nothing at all. And people read it and say, that's lovely, and move on with their day. And that, to me, is almost better. Don't tell our bosses. Yeah. But that sometimes feels like it's a saner way to live life.
So here's what I would like to do as just sort of a caboose on this episode here, is that last week we had Miriam Elder and Mike Hogan, our,
fearless
leaders.
Just
call them the management, right? But we love them,
in
and they're smart,
sense.
Great people.
Yes.
They're great, and they are the best bosses we can hope for. And they were on the podcast, and we were talking about the Beatles thing. Which has a very long tail of discussion in the culture right now, because it's freaking long.
We're
but
still
I
halfway
know you
through
didn't
it.
Get to contribute.
Oh my God, I'm obsessed. Yeah. Wait, can I give you my overarching takeaway? I have two.
Yes.
One's more important than the other. I'll give you my least important one first. I cannot believe this is real. I keep reminding myself that this isn't like a recreation. I cannot believe this exists. It's astounding to me. And I'm riveted. We're rationing it. And there's so much of it that it's crazy that we're rationing, but we're rationing it. And my second takeaway is, who's hotter than Paul McCartney?
Yeah. Cute guy. Well, he's in his high cuteness, too, because he's got the beard, right?
It's the turtleneck for
me. He looks like a kind of, I think I described him as like a sea captain in my first write-up of it over the summer. He's got this sort of like, kind of romantic look about it, right?
I mean, I'm sure Lee appreciates it so much, but about like 17 times every night, I'm like, who's sexier than Paul McCartney in this footage? Like, there's just, it's distracting. And yes, he's an incredible songwriter.
He's handsome and mega talented. He's like every time he just starts to be, how about this guy with song, guys? And he starts playing, you're like, oh my God.
It's wild. I've never seen anything like it in my entire life.
It is remarkable, and what an interesting concept. I mean, it was a collision of two kind of extraordinary things. One is that there's this much footage of the Beatles during this protracted, this tiny little bit of time, and that Peter Jackson had the idea, you got 60 hours of the footage of the Beatles for a month. That's a reality show. That's all the footage you need to make the most incredible reality show. But it's set in January 1969, and it's real.
As a reality queen, I feel like I am an authority on the subject. I've never seen anything like this, and I am riveted.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and they're not even like that self-conscious about it,
It's the opposite. I feel like they should. I like want to go back in time and be like, hello. Do you not know there are cameras? You guys are insane, but I'm so happy for it.
Yeah. Well, it has been the bright spot of the season for me to be able to constantly indulge in that. And it returned me to all my Beatles records. And I've just been kind of like geeking out. And I don't feel alone in my geekiness. I feel like the entire world is sharing my nerdy thing. It's like Peter Jackson turned us all into nerds.
You're suddenly the coolest person in school, Joe. But I will say, I actually feel so sad. And I, as much as I say how much I'm fangirling over McCartney, I equally as often I say to Lee, God, I wish Joe were here because I would kill to watch this with him. I have so many questions and I kind of need you in real time to be there answering my questions as someone who is not a super fan, just like a mild fan of the Beatles, that I don't know enough of the context. I think it would be so much cooler to watch it with you. So maybe I'll make you rewatch the entire series with me by my side so I can get your full commentary.
Yeah. That'd be amazing. Like,
or you should do a director's cut. Yes.
I was going to say, it's like the DVD director's cut.
Yes.
From a time when there were DVDs. But yes, I would be happy to do that for you, give you all sort of private trivia that will, you'll be buried in information you'll never use again.
I'd be gladly buried. I have to pick up on your bright spottedness. This has been a bright spot for me. In this period, and it has made my day, and I just wish everyone bright spots. Your McKay profile is a bright spot for me. I urge everyone to go read that, and we're just going to keep plugging away. And as we get closer into the holiday season, looking for these bright spots, I hear my bright spot waking up for her nap right now, so I'm going to go tend to her, but we will be right back here next week.
She's sort of our producer. She kind of knows when to wind it down.
Well, she is nothing if not an alarm clock.
That's our show this week. Thank you to Emily Jane Fox and her dog and her baby for all coming onto the podcast this week. Thanks to our producer, Brett Fuchs. Thanks to the people at Cadence 13 who helped make this happen. If you like what you're hearing, hit subscribe. Come back. We have something special next week. Please support our sponsors the way they support this program. And we'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.